800-984-9633. Food.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another live edition of the Global Reality right here on the Oracle Broadcasting Network. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. This is the Monday edition, Monday, January the 5th, 2009, and we will be live here with you for the next 4 hours. And boy, oh boy, as always, it is always is on Monday. We've got a big, big amount of news and information to get into today on the show, and we're going to get into our normal amount of information and news today. I've got a big story to lead off with today because well, to be honest with you, folks, when you're right, you're right. And a couple of weeks ago with the plane crash of Mike Connell, I had told you the real reason behind it, who really was behind that. And we went over quite a bit of information pertaining to that, to the real person behind the election rigging in 2004 for Bush. And, well, we'll be getting into that. You know, they could have waited for this guy to be dead for at least 2 weeks before they give him a promotion, you know, but, oh no, of course, certainly not. Here we are, and, they already have, so we'll get into that as well. Quick programming note for you. Well, we closed down 2008 with a great show on New Year's Eve where we had a surprise guest. We had Mr. Chris Everard from Enigma TV, the Illuminati films, the Secret Space films, the Spirit World films. And if you didn't get a chance to hear that show on New Year's Eve, go back and listen to the December 31st archives of that show. You missed a great one if you didn't hear that one. And we got into a lot of really interesting information. Nonetheless, let's get into the news and information right here, right now. You know, again, when you're right, you're right. And when the Republican IT expert Mike Connell died in a plane crash and they started trying to pin the election rigging to him immediately, I came on here and went through all this information about the former Secretary of State in Ohio, Ken Blackwell, J. Ken Blackwell, Council for National Policy member, who along with his Council for National Policy buddies, who own the Diebold and ES&S voting machine software, rigged the election in 2000 and 2004 for George W. Bush. And immediately, you know, when the Mike Connell situation happened, I said, look, you know, I've laid out all the information about how Ken Blackwell was the one responsible for this and knew that this was them eliminating the only witness. Because now Ken Blackwell or any of these other criminals or Rove or another rest of them are going to be brought to justice and a dead man's going to be pinned down with his crime. Well, lo and behold, ladies and gentlemen, not even 2 weeks after it happens, here we go. Conservative leaders endorse Blackwell for RNC chair, and my goodness, it's a who's who of Council for National Policy members endorsing it. And of course, you know, Ken Blackwell, Big Ken Blackwell, who did he take on his campaign with him? Last time he ran for governor a couple of years ago, none other than his other CMP buddy, Larry Pratt. Boy, I cannot wait till this film is done. We're in the process of buying our footage right now. We're almost done with that. Lee Rogers and I worked on it over the weekend. And we've got some footage in this movie that's going to blow your mind. I mean, it's literally going to blow your mind. It was blowing my mind finding the footage. I mean, stuff I didn't even know existed. I mean, it's damning stuff. And, I mean, my goodness, folks. You know, Ken Blackwell, when he was Secretary of State of Ohio, you realize this guy, you ask yourself this, even if you're a skeptic, ask yourself this. Ask yourself why a guy who has buddies and has ties with the voting machine industry, ES&S, Akoya, Diebold, don't you find it convenient that a guy who has, you know, friends that create the software for the voting machines would also conveniently, while he's in office, have a law written in the state of Ohio which declares in a local election, state election, presidential election, dog catcher election, doesn't matter what kind of election it is, small or large, if voting fraud is found in the state of Ohio, ladies and gentlemen, you cannot contest the vote under any circumstances. This is a law that he passed. Well, what a convenient law for someone who's in bed with the voting machine software companies to pass, isn't it? Well, listen to this. I mean, again, not 2 weeks after Mike Connell dies in a plane crash, the guy who's really behind it is now getting a promotion. Conservative leaders endorse Blackwell for the RNC chair. They're gonna seat this guy in the chair of the RNC, ladies and gentlemen. That's quite an upgrade. Former Ohio Secretary of State Ken Blackwell has some powerful names behind him in his run to chair the Republican National Committee. Blackwell is currently the vice chairman of the RNC Platform Committee. Business leaders, political figures, and self-appointed moral policemen are among those supporting Blackwell. Now listen to this. This is a who's who of Council for National Policy members. Listen to this. Among those supporting Blackwell include Reagan-era Attorney General Ed Meese, Focus on the Family founder James Dobson, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins, and media mogul Steve Forbes. Their endorsement came after a review of a January 2nd questionnaire filled out by Blackwell and his five competitors. Blackwell then was a notable figure in the 2004 presidential election, during which he was simultaneously the chief election official of Ohio and honorary co-chair of the committee to re-elect George W. Bush. He was sued by the Ohio Democratic Party, accused of disenfranchising minority voters, in part by forcing some to cast provisional ballots, which were at additional risk of being thrown out if cast at the wrong precinct. Blackwell, then a stockholder in the company, also ordered Diebold touchscreen voting machines over protests from Ohio State Senator Jeff Jacobson in 2003. That's right, Blackwell was a stockholder in Diebold, and lo and behold, I mean, that should have been a conflict of interest right there. The guy should have been locked up for that. But did he? Nah. Nah, not when you got Karl Rove and Cheney and Bush behind you. Nah, surely not. I mean, this guy Blackwell is an absolute scumbag. I mean, this guy, you know, we've done a great job here exposing him, but, I mean, he needs to be exposed even more. So, I mean, this guy is, you know, a stockholder in Diebold, and here he is, you know, making sure that Ohio gets those voting machines. I mean, it's just great stuff. Despite the machine's dubious accuracy and lack of paper trails, a fundraising letter sent to Ohio Republicans around the same time by former Diebold chairman Walden O'Dell sparked allegations of a conflict of interest with the statement that he was committed to helping Ohio deliver its electoral votes to the president. Well, you're damn right he was committed. He was committed to making sure that vote got rigged no matter what, and it damn sure did. The presidential vote for Ohio, one of the key states, and aside from the 2004 results, were also rerouted through a Tennessee web hosting company known for its close ties to the Republican Party and its hosting of external Bush administration email accounts. Top-level Republican IT consultant Mike Connell, set to testify in federal court about alleged GOP tampering with Ohio's votes results, died in a December plane crash. Connell had earlier said he had been under pressure to be the fall guy, confiding that he was being threatened. Well, if that's exactly the offer they gave him. They made him an offer that he couldn't refuse. I mean, Connell openly stated he was being pressured to be the fall guy. He openly stated he was being threatened. So either way, they were going to make Connell be the fall guy. And he could either do it dead or alive. And, you know, he chose to do it dead. And that's exactly what they gave him. 168 RNC members will select their next chairman at a meeting in Washington, D.C. at the end of January. I mean, this is absolutely unbelievable. Because, you know, I've been following this case as long as I've been on air. I've been following Blackwell. I've been following his moves. I've been following this vote rigging stuff. I've been following what's going on up in Ohio. And, I mean, my goodness, does it get any more obvious than to have Ed Meese, James Dobson, Tony Perkins, and Steve Forbes come out and get behind this guy? And I say that all these people that get behind, they're all complicit in the murder of Mike Connell as far as I'm concerned. You know, they're all complicit in the murder of Mike Connell as far as I'm concerned. I mean, this is unbelievable stuff. But, I mean, some of this stuff we've got, some of this footage we found for the secret right we've been buying from news articles is unbelievable stuff. I mean, especially stuff on the Heritage Foundation and all this stuff. We actually found a clip of Ronald Reagan saying his entire cabinet was run by the Heritage Foundation. Oh, man. I mean, you know, this film is just going to be an absolute goldmine. I tell you what. Oh, man. And I'm definitely going to put the Connell story and the Jake and the Blackwell thing in there. But just because of the information, some of this information is 20, 30 years old in some cases. But just the more stuff we find out. Like this character, General John K. Singlob, who was one of the founding members of the group involved in Iran-Contra. He was, this guy's ex-OSS, one of the founding members of the CIA, founding members of the Western Goals Foundation and the World Anti-Communist League. I mean, this is one of the, you know, I mean, he's the Knight of Malta, one of the key architects of the Kennedy assassination. This guy wanted to drop the neutron bomb on Korea and got mad when Jimmy Carter didn't do it. Tell ya, some serious folks here we're dealing with. But nonetheless, yeah, I mean, that story with Blackwell, I mean, you can imagine my shock when, you know, here we are 2 weeks after the plane crash of Mike Connell, and they're already giving this guy a promotion, you know, becoming the head of the RNC. and having all the heads, you know, the who's who, Ed Meese, James Dobson, Tony Perkins. My God. Surprised Beelzebub himself didn't come out and give him an endorsement. Maybe he will at some point. That just gets more unbelievable every day. Russia wants warships stationed around the world. Over the past few weeks, remember a couple of weeks ago when we talked about Russian warships being off the coast of Venezuela and then off the coast of Cuba. And then we played that clip, and there's a clip there where Condi Rice said, we're not worried about it. Doesn't bother us. Pentagon said, no, we're not worried about that. Doing now. I'm not sweating it at all. Well, now, Russia, that's not good enough. Now, Russia says, well, we got away with that. Well, we'll get away with it all then. Now, Russia wants warships stationed all over the world. You see what's going on here, right? Do you realize we're on the brink of World War III right now? We'll come back from the break in a couple of minutes. We're going to talk about the resignation of our good friend, what's the criminal's name? I can't remember. Bill Richardson. Bill Richardson was somebody, I remember four years ago, I was saying that my prediction for the presidency in 2008 was going to be Hillary Clinton and Bill Richardson. I predicted Bill Richardson would be vice president, keynote speaker, at the Bohemian Grove a few years ago, Bilderberg Group member. We're starting to see a shift here, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to talk about it on the other side because people don't believe that there's infighting, can't believe there's infighting going on within the realm and scope of the New World Order, but there is. You've got one level of people that are acting on behalf of Israel that want the smaller type of skirmishes. Then you've got the other end, your Brzezinskis and your other end who want the big kills. You know, they don't want to mess around with this little piddly stuff like what's going on in Gaza and what's going on in Iran and stuff. They want to launch World War III, but they want to do it on their terms. We're going to talk about that, and I'll analyze that for you in a bit. So that's what's going on. But anyway, Russia's military leaders approved a plan by the Navy on Sunday to station warships permanently and currently post across the globe. Underfunded since the 1991 breakup of the Soviet Union, the Russian Navy has been reasserting itself over the last year by chasing Somali pirates around the coast of East Africa, streaming across the Atlantic to visit allies in South America. And again, they want to be, this is part of, we'll talk about this, we'll get into the into this other stuff. We're going to talk about the ramp up to World War III because it's here, and there's just so many indicators right now. We got to be on our P's and Q's right now, paying attention, folks. More on the other side, Monday edition of the Global Reality right here on Oracle Broadcasting. I'm your host, Josh Reed. Stay with us.
Hi, folks.
That's LibertyStickers.com, the world's most dangerous stickers.
Howdy. Thomas Jefferson said, information is the currency of democracy. Dr. Mary's Monkey, 556-2012.
Protein, and this nutrient can be stored up to 5 years when vacuum packed and is priced affordably to be used as a storable. The body will heal itself given the proper nutrition. Change your life, work.
Hi, neighbor. When the dollar and economy crash, genetically poisoned food is all that's left. When the quarantine and bird shit, our only protection and only chance to be fearless is having control of our own supply of enough of it. But if you knew what, you wouldn't waste time listening to the rest of this announcement before charging out and decide, but can you afford to be wrong? Place your bet. Can you afford to be wrong? We haven't yet discovered 95633 food.
As America limps on its lost legs,
thank you.
Global Reality on this Monday edition of the show. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. I want to thank you for being with us today. We got a lot of news, a lot of information, a lot of ground to cover today. Hey, we knew it was, you know, here we are in the early days of 2009. We knew it wasn't going to be long before this stuff started happening, of course, especially with Obama taking office. We knew it was going to be very quickly, but nonetheless, we're going to have a lot of stuff to get into. And Crystal says Bill Crystal says in Gaza invasion is a favor for Obama. Well, that's just good stuff. Bill Crystal, you're such a little socialist scumbag. Yeah, we know about your daddy was a communist. We know all about it. You're such a little worm. Oh, man. I wish there was certain words I could say on the broadcast. Oh, Brian Bill Crystal. Oh, Bill Crystal, he said President-elect Barack Obama should be thankful for Israel's attack on the Gaza. If you care about the peace process, you should want Israel to embarrass and humiliate Gaza. That's the only chance there would be. No peace process if Hamas was governing Gaza. Wow. That's good stuff. But you know what? Let's play this clip of this slime bag, Crystal. Here it is. Give me just 1 second to get it ready.
We are peace seekers. We have restrained ourselves for a long time, but now is the time to do what needs to be done.
That was Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak explaining Israel's decision to launch a ground assault into Gaza. And we're back now with Britt, Mara, Bill, and Juan. So, Mara, are you surprised that Israel finally... What are the risks and rewards here for both Israel and Hamas?
Well, I'm not surprised because they can't just do it from the air, as they learned in Lebanon. They say they've learned a lot of lessons from that catastrophe and are going to do it right this time. I think that the only good thing for President-elect Obama is that it's happening now instead of after January 20th. I think the bad thing for him is that he had promised a very aggressive early push, diplomatic push on the Middle East peace process, and he was going to use his kind of international honeymoon to see if he could get something done there. I think this makes it a lot harder, unless somehow this Israeli offensive can delegitimize Hamas, which seems like a long shot. I mean, it certainly didn't work with Hezbollah in Lebanon. They actually ended up looking stronger. But if it can do that, then I think the new Obama administration would have an opening.
Bill, I want to pick up on the comparison to Lebanon, because as we saw with the Israeli invasion of southern Lebanon taking on Hezbollah 2 years ago, once you get in, it's hard to get out, and it's very hard to get out on your own terms. How does Israel ensure that it so degrades Hamas that they can stop the firing of those short-range missiles from Gaza into the neighboring Israeli village?
Nothing is sure in war, but first of all, there hasn't been firing across the border from Lebanon in the last 2 years. So even though that operation was messed up in many ways, and they strategically didn't accomplish its objectives in that narrow sense, it has been safe in northern Israel for the last 2 years. If they could accomplish that for southern Israel and stop the rocket firing, I think that would be a pretty real achievement. Ehud Barak was not defense minister. He was a critic of the way Lebanon happened. He was a critic of the way it occurred. He's a serious military man. He presumably has studied the lessons of Lebanon. And I think the Israelis have a theory about how they can go in, take out some of the leaders of Hamas, and especially destroy the tunnels, which have been used to smuggle in, especially these more advanced rockets from Iran, and really make it much harder for even if Hamas remains in control of Gaza, it'll be a more tenuous control. Israel will have the ability to continue bombing if they go back in, and they may be able to pretty well suppress the ability to fire these longer-range rockets into southern Israel. And above all, they can defeat Hamas. I mean, I think if you care about the peace process, you should want Israel to embarrass and humiliate Hamas. That's the only chance. There would be no peace process if Hamas were governing Gaza. I mean, that would be the worst thing for Obama. This is a favor for Obama if it delegitimizes and weakens Hamas.
But of course, that's always the problem, Juan, is how do you delegitimize? I mean, some people would say that Israel ended up beating Hezbollah, and yet the Hezbollah leaders, Nasrallah, ended up appearing to be heroes because they had survived the Israeli attack. I mean, Hamas could be empowered by all this.
I think that's my fear, that by making them your enemy and legitimizing them as a real combatant, you, in essence, raise them up. The challenge here, it seems to me, as we look forward, you know, towards next week and beyond, Ehud Barak said, this is not going to be short, and it's not going to be easy. So what does he mean? It seems to me you're aiming, therefore, at Israel having to occupy Gaza.
Well, they say they're not going to occupy.
But how else are you going to, in fact, stop these folks from firing these rockets? Now, these rockets come periodically. I think it's disproportionate to say you have 440 Palestinians dead, you have 4 Israelis dead, but I understand the sense of weakness and vulnerability that the Israelis feel that their neighbors are firing these rockets. So they go in there, okay, And I agree with Bill. If we could get Hamas out of the picture, that would be better. If you really want peace, you cannot have people who do not acknowledge the legitimacy of Israel. But at the same time, then, to go in there, it seems to me you have to have a plan to get out. And I don't think they have a plan to get out. And that's why I'm talking about the possible necessity for Israel to stay there for years to come. And I think that just makes the situation all the more volatile.
Wow, did you hear that? There was actually, they won't have that guy back on. I don't remember his name. He was a black fella, but I don't know who that guy was, but he won't be back on Fox News. Certainly not. Not after he just stated some truth in there. Did you hear that? Oh, boy, they were quick to jump all over it and make sure they neutralized that, didn't they? Did you hear that? When he talked about Israel going in and occupying Hamas. Oh, well, they said they'd have been there, not going to occupy it. I don't give a rat's ass what they said they're going to do or haven't done. 2 + 2 = 4, and we know what they're doing, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, my God, they jumped all over him like white on rice, man. I mean, they were all over it. Oh, no, they haven't said they haven't. They're not going to occupy it. No. I mean, come on. That's the whole plan. That's the whole goal, is to take it over. I mean, my goodness. Crystal, he's such a slime bag. Ugh. Man, but, this is the same old thing. And you think, if you think that Barack Obama and, of course, Joe, I'm proud to be a Zionist, you don't have to be a Jew to be a Zionist. I am a Zionist. Joe Biden, I mean, if you think they're Israel's bitch, oh, goodness gracious. Well, you know who's had the leather and the gag balls for years, Crystal himself. I mean, my goodness, I mean, he just loves this. Of course he loves the Barack Obama cabinet. It's all his buddies. It's just a continuation of the Bush presidency. We all know that. Come on. All right, more on the other side. Monday edition of the Global Reality, folks. Stay with us.
Lee Rogers here, and empower yourself with the news and information the corporate controlled mockingbird don't want you to know about.
Many people do not realize that fans and networking partners per week visit our website to review real testimonials and more. Unlike many others, we guarantee legitimate work. .com.
You are now at the home of Cutting Edge Talk Radio.
It is this inextricable tie. It is this inextricable tie between culture, religion, ethnicity, that most people don't fully understand, that is unique and, how can I say it? So strong with Jews worldwide. I used to say early on when I was a kid, I'd say when I was a young senator, I'd say, if I were a Jew, I'd be a Zionist. I am a Zionist. You don't have to be a Jew to be a Zionist.
There you go. There is Joe Biden there for you, telling you how he feels. And I put the video clip there in the chat room there for you as well. But yeah. So yeah, that's not my word. That's his. There he is. I mean, just smiling. And of course, you also have Rahm Shalom Emanuel, but literally, But anyway, so he says it's so strong, and Biden standing in front of this Jewish guy And as he says those things, so it's so inextricably tied. And he wraps his hand around the microphone as if it's some sort of phallus. No, I'm not making it up. I'm not being funny. You got to watch that clip. Just go type Joe Biden on Shalom TV into YouTube, and you'll find that clip if you're not in the chat room there, if you want to see it yourself. But there he is. I mean, literally. Like he's getting ready to, you know, give oral pleasure to the microphone on behalf of Israel or something. I mean, literally. Unbelievable. But, I mean, you know, you can't make that type of stuff up. You got to hear it. That's one of those things you got to hear for yourself. But we got a lot more stuff to talk about, lots to get into today, lots of other news. I've been predominantly talking about this stuff today because, of course, well, that's what everybody's talking about, so I had to talk about it a little bit so then we can move on from it. But I mentioned this one earlier. I want to get into this one now. From Press TV, depleted uranium found in Gaza victims. Medics tell Press TV they have found traces of depleted uranium in some Gaza residents wounded in Israel's ground offensive on the Strip. I'm sorry, I just looked down the chat room. Saw it. what Delphi wrote in the chat room. I'm just about to lose it on air here. I'm sorry. Norwegian medics told Press TV correspondent Akam Al-Zatari that some of the victims who have been wounded since Israel began its attacks on the Gaza Strip on December 27th have found traces of depleted uranium in their body. The report comes after Israeli tanks and troops swept across the border in Gaza on Saturday night, opening a ground operation after 8 days of intensive attacks. No, of course it's not legal to use depleted uranium. No, it's not legal to use any of this stuff. You think they care? Hell no. This is about genocide. Do you realize the half-life of uranium? You know what that is? I mean, they don't care, folks. This is about genocide. This is the new crusade. This is the Crusades 2.0, as I've deemed it. Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak warned on Sunday that the wide-ranging ground offensive in the Gaza Strip would be full of surprises. Did you hear that? Ehud Barak warned that the Gaza Strip offensive would be full of surprises. Well, I guess he was exactly right. You know, see, you got to read between the lines here. They tell you the truth. That's how they get away with this stuff. You know, we always call these people liars and senators. No, they're not really liars. What your definition of the truth is, I suppose. Or your, you know, that it's right there. A ground offensive in the densely populated Gaza is expected to drastically increase the death toll of the civilian population. The latest assaults bring the number of Palestinians killed to over 488, with 2,790 others wounded. The UN says that about 25% of the casualties were civilian deaths, including at least 34 people. Well, of course. Of course. Do you think they really care about killing Hamas or killing these alleged terrorists? And, of course, Hamas is the leadership are in the intelligence community, CIA, MI6, Mossad. Who do you think the leadership of Hamas is, folks? It's the same old thing as Al-Qaeda. Hamas, Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, it's all the same thing. They have the leadership that are intelligence operatives. They train the little young ones, the little youngsters to believe they're fighting for a jihad, then they send them out to get obliterated. That's what they do. That's what it's all about. There's nothing more to it than that. It's exactly what they do. I mean, global condemnation of the ongoing violence in the region. The U.S. Security Council failed to agree on a united approach to resolve the crisis. Once again, the world is watching in dismay the dysfunctionality of the Security Council, U.N. General Assembly Chief Miguel Descato said on Sunday. According to diplomatic sources, the U.S. blocked the Security Council resolution, with U.S. Deputy Ambassador Alejandro Wolf arguing that an official statement that criticizes both Israel and Hamas would not be helpful. Yeah. No. We wouldn't want to criticize both of them. We wouldn't want to criticize Israel at all. That's really what he's trying to say there, ladies and gentlemen. The White House has so far declined to comment on whether an Israeli ground incursion into Gaza is a justified measure. Well, we know Bush gave the green light. You know, we know Bush gave the go ahead. Who do you think's been funding these people? Who do you think? You realize whose weapons are being used over there, right? You realize where they got the white phosphorus rounds and the DU shells and all this. They got them from us. You know? I mean, it's like the old Bill Hicks show. You know, how do you know we fund them? How do you know we aren't them? We looked at the receipt. Yeah, exactly. I mean, goodness, man. We're arming the genocide because the genocide is happening on behalf of the people that control our country. Do you realize that? You know? Oh, man. It's enough to give you a headache some days. Because you get to this point where, you know, you're just like, look, it's so obvious, it's so in your face. How much more proof do you need? How much more evidence do you need? How much more of this can we talk about? How much longer can we go over and over and over this? We're more like the proxy state of Israel. Everything's done on behalf of Israel. That's what it's all about. The mechanisms that want the expansion of a greater Israel have set up our country centuries ago to use us as an engine to conquer the world on behalf of Israel, to set up their phony state because they believe it's the Holy Land. And these people really, seriously, think that they can engineer the end times. They really think that if Jesus doesn't come down out of the clouds and save people, that proves that the Antichrist and Satan exists, and they can set up their reign here on earth. This is what these people believe, man. Second hour around the corner, folks. Stay with us.
Amendment in the Bill of Rights limits the government's power by ensuring freedom of speech as stickers.
Howdy.
Back here with you, second hour of this Monday edition of the Global Reality right here on the Oracle Broadcasting Network. I'm your host, Josh Reed. Thank you so much for being with us today. Lots more news and lots of information to get into today on the duration of this four-hour broadcast. Very interesting stuff here, and I'll segue into the standard how to support us line. But Wikipedia to stay free as readers rush to the rescue. I talked about it a couple of weeks ago where it was laughing because Wikipedia was asking for donations. They ended up raising $6 million in like 2 weeks. $6 million to save a propaganda outlet that lies and doesn't even put factual information and edits you if you do put factual information in there anyway. You believe that? $6 million? Unflippin' believable. And we get criticized for having ads on our network, for wanting to get money in so we can make films or we can have pay for streams and bandwidth. We get criticized for that, but yet Wikipedia goes out and begs and gets $6 million, and that's somehow acceptable? I just don't get it. Users of Wikipedia have seen off a threat that the website would be forced to carry advertisements. Oh, no. Well, every other damn website has to carry advertisements or charge for access after one of the most successful online fundraising campaigns ever. The free online encyclopedia was struggling to raise $6 million to cover its running costs for 2009 and launched a campaign seeking donations on November 3rd. Money was coming in at a rate of about $30,000 a day, but the drive appeared unlikely to reach its goal, which was $4.5 million more than the $1.5 million the site raised to cover costs last year. So Wikipedia's founder, Jimmy Wales, took the unusual step of publishing a personal appeal for donations, warning that unless the target was reached, the site might be forced to start carrying adverts, which at the moment it does not do, and even introduced a subscription fee. In his letter, which was posted online on the 23rd December, Mr. Wells wrote, Wikipedia is different. Blah, 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 blah. His tactic worked. In the following 24 hours, the site received 8,186 donations compared to just 800 the previous day. Before his appeal, the site, which attracts about 254 million visitors a month, received about $30,000 a day, and that rose to more than $215,000 after the letter was published. And on January 1st, the total crept past the crucial $6 million mark. Unflippin' believable. Oh, man. Oh, man, I tell you what. These people. You know, I mean, Wikipedia doesn't even put out the truth, folks. They put out lies. They put out obfuscations. They put out things that, you know, you go and you look on there and half the time the information's wrong. I mean, caught with the feds coming in and editing that stuff. You guys seen that, right? Let's get into some other news right now. Orange drinks with 300 times more pesticides than tap water. This also is from the Daily Mail out of the UK. Fizzy drinks sold by Coca-Cola in Britain have been found to contain pesticides at up to 300 times the level allowed in tap or bottled water. A worldwide study found pesticide levels in orange and lemon drinks sold under the Fanta brand, which is popular with children, were at the highest in the UK. The research team called on the government, the industry, and the company to act to remove the chemicals and called for new safety standards to regulate the soft drink market. The industry denies children are at risk and insists that the levels found by researchers based at the University of Jaén in southern Spain are not harmful. Well, they found 300 times the level allowed in tap water. So if it's 300 times the amount found in tap water, how can they say that it's not harmful? I'm confused. I don't know. These people just confuse me all the time. The researchers tested 102 cans of bottles and soft drinks bought from 15 countries for the presence of 100 different pesticides. The UK products were bought in London, Cambridge, Edinburgh, St. Andrews, and Gatwick Airport. The experts said the levels found were low under the minimum residue. Sorry, trying to put that link there and it wouldn't go. Are low under the maximum residue levels allowed for fruit, but they were very high and up to 300 times the figure permitted for bottled or tap water. Oh, so basically what it is the experts who were doing the research found that they were low under the pesticide level, which would be considered for fruit, right? But as far as bottled water or tap water, the pesticides were up to 300 times more than the allowable figure. So what happened was is the state went back and said, No, it's safe. It's safe because the state is going by the allowable levels for fruit itself, you see. So they're trying to go back and say, no, it's safe. It's safe. These numbers are off because they're going by the fruit standard, not the standard for bottled water and tap water, idiots. The chemicals detected including carbenzidine, thiabenzol, amylazil, fluocras, malathon, and iproiodine. Well, malathon is, if I'm not mistaken, is made by, and I think most of these chemicals are made by Monsanto. They're mainly applied to fruit after harvest to stop it from developing fungal infections and rotting. A total of 19 products were bought in the UK, all made by Coca-Cola. Two orange drinks bought in the UK contain amylazole at 300 times the limit permitted for a single pesticide in drinking water. Two similar products contain 98 times the legal drinking water limit for thiabenzol. The average level of the total pesticide contamination of the British drinks was 17.4 parts per billion, 34.6 times the EU maximum residue level for water. I mean, you know, they won't even, it's like, oh, well, we're not putting those levels in water. We'll just put those levels in the drinks. Yeah. There we go. Man, Coca-Cola GB insists that the products are safe. A spokesman said all the drinks tested meet the safety regulations relating to food products made from agricultural ingredients, which include drinks with fruit juice as an ingredient. The generally minuscule levels that were detected were well within the acceptable daily level intakes, and these findings should reassure consumers that there is no safety issue here. Oh, yeah, and by the way, and mercury is good for children. It's good, yeah. Yeah, you didn't know that? Yeah, mercury is good for, it's healthy. It's good for pregnant women. It's good for infants. It's good for toddlers. You know, don't worry about the fact that the day after the EPA gave its ruling that the actor Jeremy Piven collapsed on stage from having too much mercury in his system from eating sushi. Don't worry about that. No, it's enough to put a grown man on his ass for 6 months. But women, children, toddlers, pregnant women, that's good for them. It's healthy. They can grow up big and strong. So does pesticides. Pesticides are good. They're good for kids. They're nutritious. I think kids grow up good and strong. They don't stunt growth. Yummy. Get you some more of that. Well, I tell you what, that's good stuff right there. Oh, unflippin' believable. While we're on the subject of health-related stories, let's talk about this one. 75% of physicians refuse chemotherapy themselves. The great lack of trust is evident even among doctors. Polls and questionnaires show that 3 doctors out of 4, 75%, would refuse any chemotherapy because of its ineffectiveness against the disease and its devastating effects on the entire human organism. This is what many doctors and scientists have to say about chemotherapy. The majority of cancer patients in this country die because of chemotherapy, which does not cure breast, colon, or lung cancer. This has been documented for over a decade. Nevertheless, doctors still utilize chemotherapy to fight these tumors. If I were to contract cancer, I would never turn to a certain standard for the therapy of the disease. Cancer patients who stay away from these centers have some chance to make it. Dr. Hardin Jones, lecturer at the University of California, after having analyzed for many decades statistics on cancer survival, has come to this conclusion. When not treated, the patients do not get worse, or they even get better. Many oncologists recommend chemotherapy for almost any type of cancer with a faith that is unshaken by the almost constant failures. Our most efficacious regimens are loaded with risks, side effects, and practical problems. And after all, the patients we have treated have paid the toll. Only a minuscule percentage of them is paid off in an ephemeral period of tumor regression and generally are partial. After all, for the overwhelming period of the cases, there is no proof whatsoever that chemotherapy prolongs survival expectations, and this is the great lie about the therapy. Now, there's a correlation between the reduction of cancer and the extension of life of the patient. But, you know, I mean, so there you go, 75%. 75% of physicians say that if they had cancer, they wouldn't use it. But yet, they're required to push this on their patients. And they are required to do it. Because they're owned by the medical industrial complex. They're owned by Big Pharma. They're owned by the Rockefeller family. Now, you need to read Eustace Mullins' book, Murder by Injection. And that's one of the things that's a wake-up call in that to realize that, you know, when Eustace Mullins tells you that the entire medical industry is controlled and ran by the Rockefellers, he doesn't mean, okay, they control it, yes, they own it, blah, blah, blah. No, literally, folks, there is a Rockefeller representative in every major drug corporation, in every insurance company, in every single one of them, they've got a Rockefeller representative inside there at the board table making sure that the agenda goes on. So it's not just that they, you know, that they're just sitting at the board, or that they're just behind the scenes running. No, they're literally in there making sure that the agenda goes forward. I don't know how many of you noticed it over New Year's Eve, but a lot of people's cell phones on New Year's Eve right at midnight went bonkers and just completely died. There was a big thing where all the Zooms died because of the leap year thing, there were several people that I talked to, 67 people that also had problems with iPhones and everything else, and all sorts of cell phones, where they just shut off at midnight for like 2 minutes. Very strange there that you would see this happen all the way across the board. I don't know. Well, more on the other side, Monday edition of the Global Reality Podcast. Back here with you on this Monday edition of the Global Reality, folks. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. Thank you so much for being with us today. Lots more to talk about and get into and discuss today on the duration of the broadcast. What do you mean, force us to evolve with their agenda? As far as what? Well, of course they want us to willfully go along with it. That part, of course they want us to become acclimated to this stuff. Yeah, they want us to become acclimated to all this stuff. Absolutely, they want us to accept it. You know, I talked about last week and had a listener email who'd asked me, could they become disenfranchised with the Libertarian Party, and wanted to know if I'd ever come across Bob Barr in my research. And I had trouble nailing Bob Barr to any Council for National Policy list. But then, of course, on page 128 8 of his book, The Meaning of Is, he openly talks about how he was at the 97 meeting of the Council for National Policy. They cooked up the plan to impeach Clinton. Well, this listener, also another person I was suspicious of, who was suspicious of being involved in the Council for National Policy. This gentleman who had asked this question had actually found information pertaining to this. Well, I went and did some digging on my own. He sent me a link, but I went and found the actual article back in the Wayback Machine. And this was a 2004 article published on August 20, 2004 from the New York Times. The 2004 campaign, the Conservatives Club of the Most Powerful gathers in strict privacy. And this was an article that was all done on the Council for National Policy back in 2004. Well, lo and behold, if you just look at the first page of this, you wouldn't see the meat and potatoes, but you get the second page, so the second page here, and you scroll down, and it talks about the people who were the various keynote speakers. Well, lo and behold, ladies and gentlemen, we have another one of our lovely Patriot Movement gods, as it were, that is now, who we have now fully exposed as a Council for National Policy member, and I'm ready to bring it to you and announce it to you today, ladies and gentlemen, because now we have a New York Times article to prove it. None other than Mr. Michael Badnarik. Michael Badnarik, ladies and gentlemen, often seen as he's a Patriot Radio host, and he is, with Constitution, all this stuff. Michael Badnarik, ladies and gentlemen, I knew it, but I could never prove it. I could never prove it until now. But I can prove it now with a New York Times article, and it's just going to be funny to see these little Kool-Aid drinking Patriots try to wiggle their way out of this one. Boy, I tell you what, there it is. I always knew there was something. I actually had him on. He was one of the first guests I ever had on my program. But I didn't seek to have him on. Somebody set it up for me and told him that he was a listener in my program. Well, he's now, apparently he was a keynote speaker. At the pesticide article is up at roguegovernment.com if you want to go see that article on the pesticides. Just roguegovernment.com is there, top of the Bob Barr is who we were actually talking about, who was a CMP member also. But so there you go. And I always knew he was, but it's a totally different thing when you know versus what you can prove. But that adds to the list now. I mean, look, we've got Phyllis Schlafly, we got Larry Pratt, Paul Craig Roberts, Dr. Stanley Monteith. Who else? We've got, what's the one guy's name? Not Bear, Bob Barr. But nonetheless, Bob Barr, who was the Libertarian Party candidate last year. I mean, everybody, you remember everybody's going, what in the hell? Bob Barr, ex-CIA, all this stuff. But who all do we have now? So we had Stan Monteith. We got who's the other? I can't remember the other gentleman's name. Oh, there's 7 or 8 of them now that we've got confirmed. What's interesting is to find out whose name isn't on the list. I sure wish we could get a whistleblower that would get us a current list. Boy, I tell you what. If we could get a recent CMP list, it would just blow the lid off this thing. But of course, they do an absolute secrecy. This is when I found this article, there's this gentleman, David Kirkpatrick, and I've contacted this gentleman to get him on the program before, but he just won't even respond back. But I tried to get his kick because for some reason this guy always writes articles on the CMP, and he always seems to be there, but he won't come on the show and talk about it, or he won't even respond back to me, which I think is interesting in and of itself. But, you go look at where these people work, they're always – they're always involved in black ops and everything else. So, yeah, Michael Vail, if you're listening, Michael Badnarik is now confirmed CMP. I figured you would be interested to know that. I remember Michael Vail and Doug Owen had him on one time, and he got sideways with Doug Owen. That was pretty funny. Oh, man. But, we've got to start understanding it. There's controlled opposition everywhere. What's interesting to me is what I've started to find out more in my research for the film, that's an even more daunting and scary proposition than what we thought. The CMP is not just, the Council for National Policy, from what I've found now, this is what's going to be in my film, is not just a right-wing think tank or something, as it were. It's a fully, full-fledged CIA operation. You've got General John K. Singlib, who's been a member since the very beginning. This guy was one of the founders. This guy's ex-OSS, founding member of the Western Gold Foundation, founding member of the World Anti-Communist League. He was also a founding member of the Western Gold Foundation with none other than Larry McDonald. And Larry McDonald's the former head of the John Birch Society. Now, the John Birch Society are intimately connected with the CMP. But there's no doubt, folks, the CMP is not just some right-wing think tank. It is a full-fledged CIA operation. And most of the people that I've found now that are in this group are full-fledged. I mean, they're working on behalf of the CIA. That's just the bottom line. But the group is, I mean, this was set up to infiltrate and create grassroots movements. It's an operation. And, you know, that's one of the things that I sort of, you know, assumed about the CMP. But, boy, I tell you what, now it's full-fledged confirmed. Scary stuff. All right, more on the other side. Monday edition of the Global Reality, folks. Stay with us. Cutting Edge Talk Radio. Third hour of this Monday edition of the Global Reality right here on the Oracle Broadcasting Network. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. I want to thank you so much for being with us today for the show. I want to thank all of our AM and FM affiliates out there, as well as our online affiliates as well, for carrying the broadcast. Thank you so much. You guys are an integral part of what we do here and getting the message out, however we can get it out. You know, the more the merrier, and we need all the extra listeners we can get. Quick programming note for you, that station there. My show, you won't ever no longer be able to carry my show, a 2 hours of my rebroadcast, because starting tonight, Mike Chambers and the Midnight Rider is going to 4 hours tonight, midnight to 4 a.m. Central Standard Time. And so Mike is going to be going head-to-head with the Coast to Coast AM. So there you go. So just a quick programming note for that. So there you go. Well, let's get in. I want to get into today. I want to start reading. This is something we're going to read over the course of several broadcasts. I like to get into various books and information. This one I want to get into. I think this is one of those interesting books that's sort of hard to find, but I wanted to read from this. Lots of integral information, lots of stuff maybe you probably already knew, but also things that go back and really cover the bits and pieces of the New World Order. This is a book called The World Order, A Study in the Hegemony of Parasitism by Eustace Mullins. And this is a very important book. I'm going to start now right here today with Chapter 1 entitled The Rothschilds. In its issue of December 19, 1983, Forbes magazine noted that half of Germany's top 10 banks are Frankfurt-based. The modern world financial system, an updating of the Babylonian monetary system of taxes and money creation, was perfected in Frankfurt-on-Main in the province of Hesse. Mayor Amschel Bauer, later Rothschild, discovered that although loans to farmers and small businesses could be profitable, the real profits lay in making loans to governments. Born in Frankfurt in 1743, Mayor Amschel married Gouda Schnappner. He served a three-year apprenticeship in Hanover at the Bank of Oppenheim. During this period, he had occasion to be service to Lieutenant General Baron von Estorff. Von Estorff was the principal advisor to Landgrave Frederick II of Hesse, the wealthiest man in Europe. Frederick was worth from 70 to 100 million florins, much of it inherited from his father, Wilhelm VIII, brother of the King of Sweden. Baron von Estorff advised the Landgrave that Mayor Amschel showed an uncanny ability to increase money, though its investments, the Landgrave immediately sent for him. At this time, King George III was trying to put down the American Rebellion. His troops were being outfought by the hardy Americans who are accustomed to wilderness battles. Mayor Amschel arranged for King George to hire 16,800 sturdy young Hessian soldiers from the Landgrave, a considerable addition to the Hesse's fortune. This advantageous relationship came to a halt with the sudden death in 1785 of the Landgrave, who was only 25 years old. However, Mayor Amschel obtained absolute influence over his successor, Elector Wilhelm I, who, like Mayor Amschel, had also been born in 1743. It was said that they were like two shoes, or so well did they go together. It was a pleasant change from Mayor Amschel's relationship with the former Landgrave, who had been a very difficult and demanding person. In fact, the Landgrave's sudden death had luckily placed Mayor Amschel in charge of the largest fortune in Europe. As he prospered, Mayor Amschel placed a large red shield over his door of the house in the Jungensee, which he shared with the Schiff family. He took the name Rothschild from his son. In 1812, when he died, he left 1 billion francs to his five sons. The eldest, Anselm, was placed in charge of the Frankfurt Bank. He had no children, and the bank was later closed. The second son, Salomon, was sent to Vienna, where he took over the banking monopoly formerly shared among his five Jewish families, Arnstein, Eccles, Geimuller, Stein, and Sina. The third son, Nathan, founded the London branch after he profited in some Manchester dealings in textiles and dyestuffs, which caused him to be widely feared and hated. Karl, the fourth son, went to Naples, where he became head of the occult group, the Alta Vendita. The youngest son, James, founded the French branch of the House of Rothschild in Paris. Thus strategically located, the five sons began their lucrative operations in government finance. Today, their holdings are concentrated in the Five Arrows, founded in Curacao, the Five Arrows Corporation in Toronto, Canada. The name is taken from the Rothschild sign of an eagle with five arrows clutched in its talons, signifying the five sons. The first precept of success in making government loans lies in creating a demand, that is, by taking part in the creation of financial panics, depressions, famines, wars, and revolutions. The overwhelming success of the Rothschilds lay in their willingness to do what had to be done. As Frederick Morton writes in the piece preface to The Rothschilds, for the last 150 years, the history of the House of Rothschild has been, to an amazing degree, the backstage history of Western Europe. Because of their success in making loans not to individuals but to nations, they reaped huge profits. Someone once said that the wealth of the Rothschild consists of the bankruptcy of nations. In The Empire of the City, E.C. Kunz writes, the fact that the House of Rothschild made its money in the great crashes of history and the great wars of history, the very periods when others lost their money, is beyond question. That's exactly what's going on right now. They're making their money in the great crashes of history and the great wars. Nothing has changed. On July 8, 1937, the New York Times noted that Professor Wilhelm, a German historian, had said, the Rothschilds introduced the rule of money into European politics. The Rothschilds were the servants of money who undertook to reconstruct the world as an image of money and its functions. Money and the employment of wealth had become the new law of European life. We no longer have nations, but economic provinces. On June 4th, 1879, the New York Times noted that Baron Lionel de Rothschild, head of the world-famous banking house of Messrs. Rothschild & Company, died at the age of 71. He was the son of the late Baron N.M. Rothschild, who founded the house in London in 1808 and died in 1836. His father came to the conclusion that in order to perpetuate the fame and power of the Rothschilds, which had already become worldwide, it was necessary that the family be kept together and devoted to the common cause. In order to do this, he proposed that they should intermarry and form no marital unions outside of the family, interbreeding, keep the bloodlines pure. A council of the heads of the houses were called at Frankfurt in 1826, and the views of Baron Nathan were approved. In The Rothschilds, the financial rulers of the nation, John Reeves writes, the first occasion in which Nathan assisted the English government was in 1819, and he undertook a loan of $60 million. From 1818 to 1832, Nathan issued eight other loans, totaling $105,400,000. He subsequently issued 18 government loans, including totaling $700 million. To the Rothschilds, nothing could have occurred more propitiously than the outbreak of the American Revolt and the French Revolution, as the two enabled them to lay the foundation of the immense wealth they have since acquired. The House of Rothschild was and is the ruling power in Europe. For all the political powers are willing to acknowledge the sway of the great financial despot, and like obedient vassals, pay their tribute without murmur. Its influence was so all-powerful that it was a saying, no war could be undertaken without the assistance of the Rothschilds, and that is true to this day. They rose to a position of such power in the political and commercial world that they became the dictators of Europe. To the public, the archives of the family, which could throw so much light upon history, are a profound secret, a sealed book kept well hidden. On July 27, 1844, Mazzini said Rothschild could be king of France if he so desired. The Jewish Encyclopedia 1909 edition noted that in the year 1848, the Paris House of Rothschild was reckoned to be worth 600 million francs as against 352 million francs held by all other Paris bankers. Professor Warner Sombart wrote, the principal loan floaters of the world, the Rothschilds, were later the first railway kings. The period of 1820 onwards became the age of the Rothschilds, so that at the middle of the century, it was a common dictum. There was only one power in Europe, and that is Rothschild. Her Chicago Evening America commented that on December 3rd, 1923, the Rothschilds can start wars or they can prevent wars. Their word can make or break empires. The fall of Napoleon was the rise of Rothschild. Napoleon was later slowly poisoned to death with arsenic by a Rothschild agent. They had no need for another return from exile. The New York Evening Post noted that on July 22nd, 1924, the Kaiser had to consult Rothschild to find out whether he could declare war. Another Rothschild carried out the whole burden of the conflict which overthrew Napoleon. The Kaiser's chancellor, Bethmann Hollweg, who actually precipitated World War I, was a member of the Frankfurt banking family, Bethmann and cousin of the Rothschilds. After the fall of Napoleon, Solomon persuaded the ruler of Austria to issue patents of nobility to the five brothers. The Congress of Vienna was the emergence of the moth from its cocoon. The dictate of this Congress was a simple one. The aristocracies of Europe must submit to our will, or they are doomed. The death sentence upon the noble lines of Europe was pronounced by those who had the will to carry out their edict. It took another century to perfect the work, not because the killers were weak, but because they wished to proceed cautiously, without revealing their full strength. In combat, the decisive weapon is the one your opponent does not know about. It was not necessary to pronounce a death sentence upon the ruling families of America because there was them. During the 19th century, a few descendants of colonial entrepreneurs had amassed wealth and could afford a life of leisure and travel. They remained slavishly dependent upon continental arbiters in every matter, requiring personal taste and judgment. Because they had no guiding philosophy and no program, this American, quote, upper class never made it to the top of the stairs. They remained below the stairs as servants of the London princes of the world order. Their self-abasement not only manifested itself in an unusually high rate of suicide, but also in the slower forms of self-destruction, alcoholism, drug addiction, and homosexuality. Homosexuality is not so much a type of sexual drive, it is the expression of deeper needs and the desire for self-degradation or the seeking of a partner with whom one can humiliate and degrade. It could hardly be unexpected that such a ruling class would eagerly hail the 20th century crusade to enthrone communism as the vehicle of the world order. In their quest for wealth, the Rothschilds did not overlook either the small farmer or the stockpiling and wholesaling of grain. They developed a farm loan system which has been the curse of the farmers for more than a century. R.F. Pettigrew noted in the British Guardian, the system of banking causing the ultimate ruin of all those who cultivate the soil was the invention of Lord Overstone with the assistance of the Rothschild bankers of Europe. One of the greatest triumphs was the successful outcome of the Rothschilds' protracted war against the Russian imperial family. The family name of the Romanovs was derived from Roma Nova New Rome and embodied the ancient prophecy that Moscow was to become the new Rome. The family originated with Prince Prus, brother of Emperor August of Rome, who founded Prussia. In 1614, Michael became the first Romanov Tsar. After the fall of Napoleon, the Rothschilds turned all their hatred against the Romanovs. In 1825, they poisoned Alexander I. In 1855, they poisoned Nicholas I. Other assassinations followed, culminating on the night of November 6, 1917. When a dozen Red Guards drove up a truck to the Imperial Bank building in Moscow, they loaded the Imperial Jewel Collection and $700 million in gold, totaled more than $1 billion. The new regime also confiscated the 150 million acres in Russia personally owned by the czars. And you don't think that Rothschild would fund something like 9/11 to go get all that gold? Give me a break. They did it in the past. They did it again. They'll do it over and over and over again. Of equal importance were the enormous cash reserve, which the czar had invested abroad in European and American banks. The New York Times said that the czar had $5 million in guaranteed trust and $1 million in the National City Bank. Other authorities stated that it was $5 million in each bank. Between 1905 and 1910, the czar had sent more than $900 million to be deposited in six leading New York banks: Chase, National City, Guaranteed Trust, J.P. Morgan, Hanover, and Manufacturers Trust. These were the principal banks controlled by the House of Rothschild through their American agents, J.P. Morgan and Kuhn, Loeb and Company. We'll stop right there, and then we'll take a break, come back. We're reading out of Eustace Mullins' The World Order, a study of the hegemonic parasitism. And we'll read more of that on the other side. This is The Global Reality. Stay with us.
One of the world's largest authorized TeamSpeak host providers on the net.
History will always remember the strongest voice. Your network, long live the revolution.
Josh Reeves. Today we're reading out of The World Order, a study of hegemony parasitism of the New World Order by Eustace Mullins. And there's a couple of questions going around there in the chat room. I wanted to address those. Somebody asked if Eustace Mullins was still missing. You know, he Eustace Mullins went missing back in 2006, and then he was found. And Michael Vail and Doug Owen had him on. They had him on in 2007, and then he was living in a nursing home, and Michael Vail had gotten a hold of him and talked to him several times. And then I had him on. I had Eustace Mullins on back February of last year, and I wanted to get him on again recently. And Michael Vail had given me his number in the nursing home where he was staying at, and the number was disconnected, and none of us have been able to find. I emailed the guy that was running his bookstore on eBay, which subsequently I think is not being ran anymore. So no one has been able to find any way to get in touch with Eustace Mullins or even knows where he is. So if somebody out there knows how to get a hold of Eustace Mullins, please let me know. GlobalRealityShow@gmail.com. I wanted to get him back up on the air, but I don't know I think missing may be a harsh word, but I mean, nobody really knows where he's at. So I don't know. We've called his number, and the number's disconnected, so we're going to have to just see what happens. I don't really know. But we're reading out of his book, The World Order. I think that right now, it's especially with this information on the Rothschilds, it's more important than ever to go back over this if you've never read this book. So the czar also had $115 million in four English banks. He had $35 million in the Bank of England, $25 million in Barings, and $25 million in Barclays, and $30 million in Lloyd's Bank. In Paris, the czar had $100 million in Bank de France and $80 million in the Rothschild Bank of Paris. In Berlin, he had $132 million in Mettelhausen Bank, which had long been bankers to Russia. None of these sums had ever been disbursed. Well, he doesn't have any living relatives. That's the only problem with that. I don't think he's forced into seclusion. He doesn't have any relatives. Why is he in a nursing home? Doesn't have anybody to take care of him. I mean, hell, man, I talked about it back when I had him on. If I had a way, I'd move his ass in with me. Take care of him. The guy's an American treasure. You know, there's no reason why somebody like Eustace Mullins should be rotting away in some nursing home somewhere, and it breaks my heart to even know about it. This guy should have statues of him. You know, he was the first one exposing this stuff before anybody was. You know, the guy shouldn't be just, you know, there should be no reason why we shouldn't know where somebody like him is at. He's an American treasure, and that's all there is to it. Two claimants later appeared, a son, Alexis, and a daughter, Anastasia. There's quite a great deal of proof substantiating their claims. Peter Kurth notes in Anastasia that Lord Mountbatten put up the money for court battles against Anastasia. Although he was Empress Alexandria's nephew, he was the guiding force behind Anastasia's opposition. The Battenbergs and the Mountbattens were related to the Rothschild family. They did not wish to see the Tsar's fortune reclaimed or removed from Rothschild's banks. Kurth also notes in a 1959 series on the history of the great British banks, for example, the Observer of London remarked of the Baring brothers, the Romanovs are among the first distinguished clients. There's a firm that Baring still holds a deposit of more than £40 million that was left for them by the Romanovs. Anthony Sampson, editor-in-chief, said no protests were made. This story is generally considered to be true. In the early 19th century, the Rothschilds began to consolidate their profits from government loans into various business ventures, which have done very well. Fortuitous trading on the London Stock Exchange after Waterloo gave Nathaniel Mayer Rothschild a sizable portion of the consols, which formed the bulk of the deposits of the Bank of England. Joseph Westberg notes in The Merchant Bankers, there is the Sun Alliance Life Insurance Company, most aristocratic of all insurance companies, founded by Nathan Rothschild in 1824. Brinko, the British Newfoundland Group, founded by the British and French Rothschilds in 1952, the Anglo-American Corp, Bowater, Rio Tinto, and others. Not only does the Bank Rate of England affect the interest rates in other nations, the price of gold also plays a crucial role in the monetary affairs of nations, even if they are no longer in the gold standard. The dominant role played by the House of Rothschild and the Bank of England is augmented by another peculiar duty of the firm, the daily fixing of the world price of gold. There you go. That's another interesting end of the Rothschild story, the world daily fixing of the world price of gold. I hate to get off on this, and I don't want to spend too much time derailing here, but, you know, I do think it's interesting that that's something that a lot of these gold huskers out there don't tell you about. You know, a lot of these people you hear on radio that try to, hawk their gold on you. Yeah, they don't tell you that daily the Rothschilds manipulate the gold prices. They leave that out somewhere in the information. I don't know why. I find that interesting, though, that would be left out. But I guess if you're trying to sell gold to quote-unquote patriots, puke, throwing in the fact that, oh, by the way, the Rothschilds daily manipulate the price of gold probably wouldn't be something you'd want your customers to know. The News Chronicle of December 12, 1938 describes this ritual. The story of gold fixing has often been told. How every weekday at 11 a.m., representatives of five firms of bullion brokers and one firm of refiners meet at the office of the messers. At the Rothschild, except on Saturday, and they fix the sterling price of gold. There is, however, a great deal of activity which lies behind this final fact. This centralization of the demand for and the supply of gold in one office and the fixing of the price of gold on that basis. A price of gold is first suggested, probably by the representative message. Rothschild, who also acts for the Bank of England in the exchange equalization account. The banking house privileged to meet with the Rothschilds to set the world price of gold are known as the Club of Five. In 1958, they were N.M. Rothschild, Samuel Montague, Montague and Goldsmith, Sharp, Pixley, and Johnson Matthey. In 1961, the London accepting houses, operating by approval of the governor of the Bank of England, were Barings, Brown, Shipley, Avenant, Latham, W.N. Branson Sons, Erdmanlers, Anthony Gibbs and Company, Guinness, May and Hawkins, and the list goes on and on. These chosen firms rule the financial establishment in the city of London. In 1961, the leading business groups in England were listed by W.M. Clark, and there's a whole list of those. It goes on and on. But we're coming on a break here in just a second. But, yeah, I mean, the Rothschilds constantly manipulate the price of gold. They own it all, so it's in their best interest. They create the boom and bust markets of everything, the stock markets, gold, all of them. But, nonetheless, this is exactly what these gold hustlers don't tell you. More on the other side, Monday edition of the Global Reality, folks. Stay with us.
That's GetTheTea.com. In an ever-changing world where toxins, chemicals, fluoride infiltrate every level of your system every day, take charge and...
Back here with you on the Global Reality on this Monday edition of the show. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. I want to thank you for being with us today. We're reading out of The World Order by Eustace Mullins. And this first chapter here on the Rothschilds is very important. And a lot of the information, especially this stuff about how, you know, they've always manipulated the prices of gold and and naming names on who the manipulators of the gold were. I mean, it's just unbelievable stuff. But, you know, this is one of those books that, well, it's so many of them. You know, there's some of these bookstores out there, and there's a bookstore, a truth bookstore in Austin, Texas. I was just always been shocked that every time I've ever gone in there or looked online, they don't have one single Eustace Mullins book. And I'm going, wow, for a truth bookstore to not have a Eustace Mullins book is just, unbelievable to me. I mean, this is, you know, this is the guy that was exposing the Federal Reserve and exposing all this stuff long before anybody, you know. I mean, this is one of the godfathers of truth, as it were. The Rothschilds have had a large position in Vickers for many years. The chairman is Sir Peter Matthews, also director of Lloyds Bank and Sun Alliance. And this just goes on naming names. I'm going to skip over all this. For more than a century, widespread belief has been deliberately fostered in the United Nations, or in the United States, that the Rothschilds were of little significance in the American financial scene. With this cover, they have been able to manipulate political and financial developments in this country to their own advantage. In 1837, the Rothschilds let their American representative WML and MS Joseph go bankrupt in the crash while they threw their cash reserves behind a newcomer, August Belmont, and their secret representative George Peabody of London, Birmingham notes in Our Crowd. In the panic of 1837, Belmont was able to perform a service which he would repeat in subsequent panics, thanks to the hugeness of the Rothschilds' reservoir of capital to start out in America operating his own Federal Reserve system. Ha ha ha, you see. Now you know how that whole debacle got started. That's exactly what's going on now, folks. After 1837, August Belmont was publicly advertised in the financial press as the American representative of the Rothschilds. When Belmont participated in the financial operation, everyone knew that the Rothschilds were involved. When Belmont took no part, and the transaction was handled by J.P. Morgan and Company or by Kuhn, Loeb and Company, everyone knew that the Rothschilds were not involved. They thought they knew. George Peabody had established his business in England through his connection with the Brown Brothers, now Brown Brothers, Heron Shipley. Huh? Really? Wow. So they caused the collapse. The Rothschilds funded George Peabody. They came in and set up the Federal Reserve, and George Peabody established his business in England through his connection with Brown Brothers, Harriman, and Brown Brothers, Harriman happened to be funding the Nazis along with Prescott Bush. And, of course, we know that the Rothschilds funded Hitler for the extermination of the Sephardics. He became an unidentified agent for Lord Rothschild as early as 1835, although there is no statue of George Peabody in the Wall Street area. There is one in London just opposite the Bank of England. George Peabody became the favorite American of Queen Victoria. Right. And of course he did, because he was instrumental on behalf of the Rothschilds in setting up the Federal Reserve. So no wonder there's no statue of them in Wall Street, but there sure as hell one next to the Bank of England. Do you realize who controls us yet, folks? America was set up to get free from taxation and get out from underneath the crown. That's what we do here. We're fighting them damn limeys over there. We're free from them limeys. You have been under the control of the crown as the Federal Reserve was instituted, folks. Do you realize that? Wake up. I'm so sick of the term awake. I'm awake.
I know what's going on. Hey, you're a great American. I'm awake. Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ding-dang.
You're not awake to anything. People, there are so many these truthers and people walking around thinking they're awake and they don't know anything. Who bought the Federal Reserve? What do you think they're gonna set up, folks? And we're gonna talk about this on Wednesday when we have Michael Tsarian on. What we're gonna talk, one of the key things I'm gonna get him to talk about is how people, you know, we have to fight this tyranny. We gotta get rid of this. They don't understand what comes in the back door ultimately ends up being worse than what you originally, this idea of what you're getting behind fighting is. People just don't get it. By 1861, George Peabody had become the largest trader of American securities in the world. To put pressure on the Lincoln government, he began unloading them and driving prices down. At the same time, J.P. Morgan allied with Morris Ketchum and was depleting the American gold supply by shipping it off to England. They started shipping the gold off out of here back in the Lincoln days, folks. Oh, I love it, man. I love it. Pass that Kool-Aid over here. Mmm, tastes like jet fuel and bullhorn sweat. Mmm, pass it over here. I'll take it. He ran the price from $126 an ounce to $171 an ounce, reaping a good profit and putting more financial pressure on the Lincoln government. This was one of the many financial operations directed by the Rothschilds for their own political and financial goals. Do you realize that Albert Pike was a Rothschild agent, folks. And when Lincoln was going to have him tried for war crimes, which was against the law, he fled up to Canada. He had his brother, his Mason brother, John Wilkes Booth, made him the hitman. He went and offed Lincoln, and then when it was safe, Pike came back down to America and spent the rest of his days here. He was acting on behalf of the crown even then. As George Peabody had taken no son to take over his firm, he took on Janice Morgan as a partner. Janice's son, John Pierpont Morgan, became known as the most powerful banker in the world, although his principal role was to secretly carry out commissions for the House of Rothschild. The New York Times on October 26, 1907, noted in connection with J.P. Morgan's action during the Panic of 1907 that in conversation with the New York Times correspondent, Lord Rothschild paid a high tribute to J.P. Morgan for his efforts in the present financial juncture in New York. He is worthy of his reputation as a financier and a man of wonders. How is morals and dogma propaganda? I don't understand how you can even say that this. What do you mean, was it propaganda? It's their book for the degrees of Freemasonry. It's a Kabbalistic magic manual. It programs the subconscious mind of the initiate. That's what it does. More on the other side, out of Eustace Mullins, The World Order. This is The Global Reality. Stay with us.
They took away our dog tag. They had us throw our hair.
You are now listening to the Oracle Broadcasting Network, the home of cutting-edge talk radio.
With you on this Monday edition of The Global Reality. I'm your host, Josh Reed. Thank you so much for being with us today. In this hour, reading out of The World Order by none other than Eustace Mullins, and very telling stuff here, especially how, you know, I mean, they were shipping out the gold out of this country during the Lincoln period. My goodness. I mean, if you're the last to know that we've been under the crown for over a century back underneath it, I mean, goodness. I mean, what more do you need to know? I mean, this really just lays it out in fine form here. The New York Times on October 26, 1907, noted in connection with J.P. Morgan's actions during the Panic of 1907, in conversation with the New York Times correspondent, Lord Rothschild paid a high tribute to J.P. Morgan for his efforts to the present financial juncture in New York. He is worthy of his reputation as a great financier and a man of wonders. His latest actions fills one with admiration and respect for him. This is the only recorded instance when the Rothschild praised any banker outside of his own family. Well, that shows you the power that the J.P. Morgan had, didn't it? On March 28, 1932, the New York Times noted that London N.M. Victor Rothschild, 21-year-old nephew of Baron Rothschild, is going to the United States soon to take a post with J.P. Morgan and Company. It was learned tonight. It is usual for progressive British bankers to send their young men to Western states temporarily. One of the most notable believers in the practice being the Anglo-American banking house of J. Henry Schroeder and Company. The Morgan-Rothschild connection explains the otherwise incomprehensible mystery of why J.P. Morgan, famed as the most powerful banker in the world, left such a modest fortune in his death in 1913, a mere $11 million after his death was secured. Although the present members of the Morgan family seem financially secure, none of them is counted among the big rich. In Brandis, A Free Man's Life, a Forrest T. Mason notes, young Adolf Brandis, just as Brandis' father, arrived in New York, traveled for a while in the East, and then went on to the Midwest. Young Brandis' pleasure and faculty in travel were greatly enhanced by the companionship of a young friend of the Wellis, been on a business trip to the United States to secure information about American investments for the House of Rothschild. Thanks to his companion's contracts and letters of introduction, Adolf saw places and met people not accessible to most foreigners. Birmingham notes in Our Crowd, in the autumn of 1874, Baron Rothschild summoned Isaac Settleman to his office. Some $55 million of U.S. bonds were to be offered by the three houses, the House of Siegelman, the House of Morgan, and the House of Rothschild. This was the first time that the Siegelmans had been asked to participate in an issue with the Rothschilds. They were more than grateful, and thus another ally of the Rothschilds began to operate in America. A notable advantage of J.P. Morgan's wars for the House of Rothschild was the carefully cultivated belief that Morgan, if not openly anti-Semitic, avoided participating in operations with Jewish banking firms, and that his firm would not hire anyone of Jewish background. It was the same deception which Nathan Mayer Rothschild had hired Morgan's predecessor, George Peabody, to perform in London. It was a traditional belief on Wall Street that if you wished to deal with a Gentiles-only firm, you went to J.P. Morgan. If you wanted a Jewish firm, there were a number of houses available, but the most influential by far was the Kuhn Loeb Company. In either case, the customer was never made aware that he was dealing with an American representative of the House of Rothschild. am I the only one that makes that leaves a laugh out of that? Oh, man. Don't let them know they're dealing with a dirty Jew banker. Just tell them they're dealing with an American banker. Doesn't matter. They don't let them know they're being controlled by Rothschild. Please. We won't get all that interest off that money. I love it. Jacob Schiff, who bought the Kuhn Loeb firm. I wonder if Jacob Schiff is the relative of Peter Schiff. Makes you wonder, doesn't it? Probably is. Jacob Schiff, who bought the Kuhn Loeb firm to its preeminent role in American finance, was born in the Rothschild house at 148 Zungendorf, Frankfurt, with the Rothschilds shared with the Schiff family. In 1867, Abraham Kuhn and Solomon Lowe, two Cincinnati dry goods merchants, founded the banking house of Kuhn and Lowe. In 1875, Jacob Schiff arrived from Frankfurt to join the firm. He married there Therese, Solomon's daughter. He also bought a large amount of Rothschild's capital into the firm, enabling it to expand tenfold. In 1885, Loeb retired. Jacob Schiff ran the firm from 1885 to 1920 when he died. At no time has the House of Rothschild ever indicated publicly that it had any interest in the firm of Kuhn, Loeb, and Company. George R. Conroy stated in the Truth magazine in Boston, December 16, 1912, that Mr. Schiff is the head of the great private banking house of Kuhn, Loeb, and Company, which represents the Rothschild's interest on this side of the Atlantic. He has been described as a financial strategist and has been for the years the financial minister of the great impersonal power known as Standard Oil. He was hand in glove with the Harrimans, the Goulds, and the Rockefellers in all the railroad enterprises and has become the dominant power in the railroad and financial world of America. This is one more revelation of the hidden power of the Rothschild interest in America. Not only has it directed the Rockefeller enterprises from the time that the National Bank, City Bank of Cleveland, a Rothschild bank, financed the early expansion of Rockefeller South Improvement Company, which enabled him to crush his competitors through illegal railway rebates, but it has also been the power behind the scenes of the Harriman fortunes. Now, right there he tells you that the Rothschilds were the money behind the Brown Brothers Harriman fortune, the Harriman fortune itself, and the Rockefellers. Very interesting stuff. That's a question I often get from people. And there's your answer right there. It explains the frequent appointments of W. Averill Harriman, the dominant power of the Democratic Party, while his partner's son, George Bush, is the Republican vice president, a heartbeat away from the president of the United States. It explains the secret writing of the Federal Reserve Act by Paul Warburg of Kuhn, Loeb & Company, and even the more secret deals which caused it to be enacted into law by Congress. It explains how the United States would fight World War I with Paul Warburg in charge of its banking system, to the vice chairmanship of the Federal Reserve Board. Bernard Bark, as dictator of American industry, as chairman of the War Industries Board, and Eugene Meyer, financing the war through his position as chairman of the War Finance Corporation, printing government bonds in duplicate. Kuhn Loeb partner Sir William Wiseham, with Colonel Howe's correlated British and American intelligence operations. Kuhn Loeb partner Louis L. Strauss was acting head of the U.S. Food Administration under Herbert Hoover. Meanwhile, Paul's brother, Max Warburg, headed the German espionage system. Another brother was German commercial attaché in Stockholm, traditional listening post for warring nations. And Jacob Schiff had two brothers in Germany who were financing the German war effort. It was a classic case of managed conflict with the Rothschilds manipulating both sides from behind the scenes. At the Versailles Peace Conference, Bernard Bruch was head of the Reparations Commission, Max Warburg, on behalf of Germany, except in the reparations terms. While Paul Warburg, Thomas Lamont, and other Wall Street bankers advised Wilson and the Dulles brothers on how American interests should be handled at this all-important diplomatic conference. Well, that's nothing but a bunch of knots of Malta right there. Dulles brothers involved in the Kennedy assassination after Kennedy fired them were both Knights of Malta members, as well as David Rockefeller, several of the Rockefeller's families. I mean, we know what this is. These are the people that have the money. These are the money changers, and they act on behalf of the Vatican, which controls the religious and the military. That's your New World Order right there in a nutshell. And we're coming on break here. We're coming into the fourth hour of the broadcast. I'm going to stop right there. We'll pick up back on this tomorrow. We're going to do a lot more news and information. I got some clips I want to play, as well as your phone calls on this Monday edition of the Global Reality, folks. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. Don't go anywhere. You are now listening to Cutting Edge Talk Radio. Monday edition of the Global Reality. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. I want to thank you so much for being with us today for the show. I've got a lot more to talk about here in this fourth hour of the broadcast. I want to thank everybody for tuning in. I want to thank everybody in the chat room for being in there, everybody for participating in the show today. Great stuff, both here in the chat room and all around. So I want to thank everybody. Your contributions are always welcome here on the show. I'll tell you, I'm just so excited right now. You know, we've been working on acquiring footage for the new film, The Secret Rite. And I mean, just looking at the titles of these footage when we go into search the news archives for the stuff that we're buying, I mean, some of these clips are blowing me away. I mean, there's going to be stuff in here that nobody's ever seen before. It's blowing my mind because it's just, I keep coming into more information. You know, we covered the Ken Blackwell information earlier. Or now, you know, 2 weeks after the plane crash of Mike Connell, who was the fall guy for the vote rigging in Ohio in 2004, you know, here we are 2 weeks. This guy hadn't been in the ground 2 weeks, and already they're giving him a nice promotion to be the top of the head of the RNC. Well, big picture aspect of the Council for National Policy is the fact that their roots lie in the Fabian Socialist Movement, which originated out of the Milner's Roundtable, Cliveden Set, London School of Economics, out of England, of course, and how the formation of the group was started to ensure that no matter who you vote for on either side of the phony political spectrum, you get socialism. Now, one of the key evangelical members of the Council for National Policy that you know of, that we've talked about here before, is, of course, This one even blew my mind because it's so obvious now. Pat Robertson's thoughts on 2009, and Pat Robertson just saying, hey, it's socialism, get ready for it. Well, of course. The Council for National Policy that he's a member of is bring in socialism. These people are getting real obvious. Here it is.
Well, every year on New Year's Day, our staff gathers together for a time of praise, worship, and prayer. And each year, Pat shares what the Lord has shown him about the coming year. Before we look at part of Pat's message from yesterday's meeting, we'd like to review what he predicted last year for 2008.
As I see it, the economy, we're going to have a recession worldwide. We're probably already in it. The stock market is going to have a crash.
The collapse of Lehman Brothers Investment Bank and the sale of Merrill Lynch sparked a significant sell-off on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones dropped 400 points in trading. Nervous investors fear the worst is not over.
The Dow took a major dive, taking as much as 700 points upon the initial tally. The defeat cost $1.2 trillion in market value losses as the Dow posted its biggest one-day decline in history.
Oil will go to $150 a barrel.
Another record high for oil and painful new predictions about the price of gas.
Oil is now above a record $140 per barrel. The president of OPEC says he believes oil prices might go as high as $170 a barrel this summer.
Gold at $1,000 an ounce. The dollar will continue to decline.
The high price of gold is motivating some people to sell their gold dental work and even their old gold teeth. Gold is worth nearly $1,000 an ounce, and pawn shops and other gold dealers have seen a big surge in people hoping to cash in.
Well, every year you head off to the mountains, That was last year, some of what the Lord showed you. And we want to...
I thought, as I was praying a year ago, that the major crash would be in 2009, but we had a much more severe crash. I said it would be a crash, and it happened.
It really seemed to take the experts by surprise.
Well, it didn't take me by surprise. And also, I said gold would hit $1,000. It hit $1,000. Oil, I said 150. It was 147.40 or something, so it was just a couple of dollars under 150. But I pray, and I speak with humility, is this what is going to happen? So I have a few things about the coming year.
You go away to the mountain. You get away from all of us.
That's
you
right.
Go spend time with the Lord. So we want to stop for just a moment and take a look at our New Year's Day prayer meeting happened yesterday, where Pat spoke of 2009.
So here are some of the things that I feel are going to be happening in 2009. The Lord said the economy of your nation will recover. The steps taken will lead to a dramatic increase in the power of government. The people will welcome socialism in order to relieve their pain. Nothing will stand in the way of a plan by Obama to restructure the economy in the same fashion as the New Deal in the 30s. America will never again have the power in the world that it has enjoyed since World War II. With no strong leadership, dangerous dictators will arise in various parts of the world that will threaten the peace and security of millions of people. Russia will be the most dangerous and will lead the coalition to control the Middle East. Israel is entering a period of extreme crisis. A strong government that deals forcefully with the Palestinians will bring international condemnation and sanctions against Israel. But the Lord will uphold his people despite world opinion. The hold of Islam is weakening. The violence and bloodshed has turned many against this religion of hate. And the Lord said, expand your outreach to Muslims. They are ready to listen. Great and cataclysmic things will become commonplace around the world. Poverty and misery will be widespread. There has never been, nor will there ever be, a more propitious time for the gospel. People by the tens of millions will be seeking answers. They will gladly receive the forgiveness of sins that was bought by the death of Jesus Christ.
It was really a time of wonderful prayer as we head into the new year. Were you surprised by any of the things that you felt God spoke to you?
It totally flies in the face of what all the experts are saying.
Yeah.
The experts say it's bad, it's going to get worse, and it's just going to be terrible. And the Lord is saying the recovery is going to be pretty swift. I don't have it nailed down, but I would think certainly By the beginning of the second quarter of next year, we're going to see some things happening. I think the stock market's going to turn around almost immediately.
Are we trading recession for superinflation?
Yes. It won't happen, you know, boom, boom. It'll take a while. But we're flooding the world with, and the Lord said the dollar is going to go down dramatically. And when all this happens, we will begin to have what's known as hyperinflation. And if I'm hearing him right, gold would go to about $1,900 an ounce and oil $300 a barrel. And what the Russians are getting ready to do is put together a coalition in the Middle East to try to gain control of the oil. And I think the time of the prophecy of Ezekiel 38 is at hand.
Well, talk about hyperinflation and what that would mean to people. You talked about socialism and people being willing to accept that because of the pain of what happens economically.
Well, hyperinflation is what happened to Germany right after the 20s, at the beginning of the 20s, when their currency was so badly devalued that the time came when a person could pay off his mortgage with a dozen eggs. You know, the value of things had just gone away. So it means that people who are on retirement, who have fixed incomes, that sort of thing, they'll just be decimated, absolutely decimated. They're being decimated now, but it's going to hyperinflation will make it worse. And that's normally what happens is the value, at least the nominal price of things goes up so fast that people who are merchants, people who are in business, they have a terribly hard time keeping up with it because they've got to be pricing all the time ahead of it. I've seen it in Zaire, for example. I met with the leadership in that country and warned them that if they didn't stop printing money, they were going to have a social collapse. And indeed, that's what happened. Their currency went from four to the dollar to about 40,000 to the dollar. And exactly what I said was going to happen. There was rioting in the streets. The people, you know, began to loot and pillage. There was terrible social unrest, and that's what can happen in hyperinflation.
Well, it also impacts our power as an international force in the world.
People are not going to trust the United States any longer as the leader in financial matters. What has happened already in this subprime mortgage crisis, now we've got the Alt-A mortgages coming up and these other things, the United States just hasn't proved a worthy leader, and we've gone deeply, deeply in debt. Now we're talking about $1 trillion stimulus. There's probably $7 trillion in stimulus going out already in various forms, and it may get up higher. And if we debase our currency, we will no longer be the economic leader. So we will have, what the Lord was saying is that the position of leadership the United States has had since World War II is going to be eroded. It won't be there any longer. People won't trust us. And
like trading our inheritance.
They're not going to count on the dollar as the primary currency of the world. They won't do it anymore. And so they won't price oil in dollars. They'll begin to insist on gold or some other basket of currencies or something like that. It's going to mean it'll cost everybody here will have to pay more. Imported goods will cost a lot more. And there can be a lot of pain and suffering. But initially, the people, what the Lord was saying, the people are willing to accept socialism to alleviate their pain. Mm-hmm. And the other thing the Lord was saying is, that was made clear, is that Islam is losing its grip on its adherents around the world.
As people see more and more of the reality of what the root of that is.
They're sickened by the violence, and so these radicals have undermined their own credibility, and as a result, as far as the gospel goes, there's a tremendous opportunity. We're seeing already there are millions and millions of people who are nominal Muslims who are coming to Jesus Christ. That's going to accelerate, mm-hmm. And the Lord also said that there'd never be another time in history as propitious for the gospel. It's going to be a great time for the gospel, and also a tremendous anointing of the Holy Spirit. There'll be huge miracles, unbelievable miracles.
Which is actually very prophetic for this hour.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
So that's all good news, and I think as far as the economy,
cast off the gloom and the doom because things are getting ready to turn around. Mm-hmm. And I, as I say, I'm flying in the face of all the experts, or most of the experts, who say, oh, no, it's going to get worse. Mm-hmm. But I don't think so.
Well, we'll be back in 2010.
keep me honest. But I say with humility, I hope I...
So there you go, there's Pat Robertson, and yeah, if you miss that one clip, you can go back and listen to it. But he says, oh yeah, socialism's great, socialism's going to save us. Oh, it's great, and a couple weeks ago we played you the clip where he's saying that Obama's a good thing, and he's quite pleased with what Obama's going to do. I mean, it's all smoke and mirrors, folks, it's all phony. These people are all on the same agendas behind closed doors. This guy wrote a book called The New World Order one time, for God's sakes. I mean, this guy is, look, he was predicted everything would happen in 2008. The way it happened, because he sits at the table as the people that make these things happen, folks. You hear these same kind of hucksters on Patriot Radio proclaiming themselves to be prophets because everything they predicted in 2008 came true. Well, my God, when you're plugged into this stuff, everything I predicted in 2008 would come true. I ain't up here calling myself a damn prophet. Give me a break. More on the other side. This is the Global Reality. Stay with us.
At bookstores everywhere or by calling 556-2012.
History will always remember. You're listening to the Oracle Rock, Long Live the Revolution.
On the Global Reality Monday edition of the broadcast. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. Well, I tell you what, that Pat Robertson is a real piece of work, isn't he? Another one of these Council for National Policy clowns. I tell you, I just can't wait to expose these people. But, you know, they're exposing themselves on all fronts. Let's get back into the news here. Reports say ex-Clinton aide Panetta to be named CIA director. Three news organizations are reporting that a former aide to President Bill Clinton will be named CIA director by President-elect Barack Obama. Two Democratic officials say President-elect Barack Obama has chosen former Clinton White House Chief of Staff Leon Panetta to run the CIA. The Associated Press reports Panetta was a surprise pick for the post with no experience in the intelligence world. An Obama transition official and another Democrat disclosed his nomination on condition of anonymity since it was not yet public. So yet another Clinton insider, ladies and gentlemen, headed up to run the CIA. Wow. Amazing stuff there. Not really, but nonetheless. More and more and more. Here's one from USA Today. Investors dump $89 billion in U.S. securities in a historic fire sale. The deep river of private money that helped knit together the global economy has abruptly dried up, new government figures show. As the global financial crisis grew more severe this summer, foreigners sold almost $90 billion of U.S. securities. I'm talking about a fire sale. I mean, they're looting, raping, and pillaging this country for all it's worth. The greatest quarterly fire sale by overseas investors since the government began keeping track back in 1960. U.S. investors were also retrenching. They unloaded about $85 billion worth of foreign holdings in the quarter, says the Commerce Department's Bureau of Economic Analysis. We've had a global panic. Everyone is pulling their money home, says economist Adam Posen of the Peterson Institute in Washington, D.C. That's bad for economic growth in the U.S. because it threatens to starve capital-hungry companies and entrepreneurs. But it's especially serious for emerging market countries that rely heavily on outside financing. Capital flows into countries such as South Korea, Turkey, and Brazil were evaporating even before the mid-September Lehman Brothers bankruptcy made things worse. The reversal of private capital flows signals an abrupt end to nearly two decades-long era of financial globalization, says economist Brad Sesser of the Council on Foreign Relations. They always get some CFR lackey to come out and chill for them, don't they? Private flows in and out of the U.S. for purchases of stock, corporate bonds, and federal agencies bonds have dropped around 18% of the economic output to near zero in a remarkably short period of time. Well, oh, well, isn't that special? Big shocker, big surprise there as the looting of this country continues. U.S. and Georgia to sign strategic pact. Oh, here's another shocker. No. The U.S. and Georgia being in bed together? Surely not. That's a conspiracy theory. That's a conspiracy theory. Well, at least it was back in August. You know, back in August when we were all telling everybody that U.S. was back in Georgia, that was a conspiracy theory. Well, now it's openly admitted to. Boy, oh, boy, in just a, what a few short months we'll do. Months after Georgia fought a short, nasty war with its northern neighbor, the United States is moving to shore up security ties with the former Soviet Republic. Hey, and the AFP reports that Georgian officials will sign a strategic partnership treaty on January 4th in Washington on Tuesday. The Department of State issued the first confirmation the United States and Georgia would pursue a more formal security arrangement. In response to questions from the reporter, State issued the following news release. This item has largely gone unreported in the U.S. media, but comes as both Moscow and Tbilisi continue the post-war rhetoric. In a year-end interview with some rather ambiguous Russian intelligence reporters, Russian President Dmitry Medvedev took a shot at Saakashvili. We had the impression that our neighbor was not quite right in the head, but we did not imagine it was to this degree, he said. Saakashvili said Medvedev's comments are an acknowledgement of the Russian aggression. For his part, Russian President has done little to blunt the Russian stereotype that he's a hot-headed southerner. The Russian press, in fact, gleefully picked up on a report from a Georgian tabloid that Saakashvili recently punched and threw a phone at his prime minister. Folks, what did we talk about in the show? The rampant of World War III. This is all a part. It's all staged. It's all phonies. People are all in bed together, and they're going to fly out on C-130s once the bombings and the bullets and the rockets and everything starts flying. Just like Ahmadinejad. It's like dinner jacket, members-only boy up there in Iran. As soon as this stuff starts going down, he's going to fly off to Frankfurt, Germany in a C-130, and he's going to be held in seclusion at an airbase. While Iran's getting the crap bombed out. This is, I mean, it's big phony. It's smoke and mirrors of the public. It's a movie. You're buying a movie. Your tax dollars are paying for your ticket to watch this global blockbuster play out every single day, and that's what's happening. Meanwhile, political upheaval continues in Tbilisi. Saakashvili ordered a cabinet shakeup last month on Wednesday, Georgia UN ambassador, a former envoy to the breakaway Republic of Abkhazia, announced he had resigned the post to join the opposition. People flipping sides, people jumping over here, all this stuff going on. I mean, if that wasn't good enough, check this out. Here's another one from Wired today. Al Jazeera to come pre-installed on some Sony phones. The Al Jazeera network has announced a partnership with Sony Ericsson where RSS feeds of its news content will be pre-installed on four models of its mobile devices in both the Middle East and North Africa. So, and it goes to those of you who don't know, of course, Al Jazeera is the Fox News of the Middle East. It's their propaganda arm. And so they're going to start installing Al Jazeera feeds on Sony Ericsson phones. Now, pre-installed with propaganda. I mean, just unbelievable stuff. All right, final half hour on the court. Lots more news to get into. This is The Global Reality. I'm your host, Josh Reed. Stay with us.
Your greatest asset. So try it today, store it today, and change your life.
Hi neighbor, this is Steve Shank, Fearless Task Force. Life is a gamble, but you can stack the deck. Decide now. Place your bet. Can you afford to be wrong? 3.
RoadGraphics.com and BlacklistNews.com feature raw, fully sourced information with no intrusive advertising. Be sure to visit these sites and empower yourself with the news and information the corporate controlled mockingbird don't want you to know about.
Network.
I can feel it inside of me.
Monday edition of the Global Reality. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. Tons more news to get into in this final half hour today. I want to thank everybody for tuning in. Let's continue on now today with the news here. EPA says cow tax to charge $175 per dairy cow to curb greenhouse gases. Yes, you heard me right. I'm not joking around here. I'm not trying to be funny. Folks, they are now instituting, the EPA is now going to institute a cow fart tax. Yes, you heard me right. Call this one of the newest and innovative, the ways your government has come up to battle greenhouse gas emissions. Indirectly, it could be considered a cheeseburger tax. But one of the suggestions offered by the Environmental Protection Agency in its advanced notes of proposed rulemaking for regulating greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act is to levy a tax on livestock. The NPR released early this year would give the EPA the authority to regulate greenhouse gas for not only greenhouse gas from man-made sources like transportation and industry, but also sources which would include livestock. The New York Farm Bureau assigned a price tag to the cost of greenhouse gas regulation by the EPA in a release last month. The tax for dairy cows could be $187 per cow or $87.50 per head of beef cattle. The tax on hogs would be upwards of $20 per hog. And any operation with more than 25 dairy cows, 50 beef cattle, or 200 hogs would have to obtain permits. This is all about making sure that food only comes through the Soylent Green manufacturers. That's what this is about. This is about making sure that, it's a cow fart tax. It's what it is. It's making sure that you get nothing but Soylent Green. I mean, you know, have you guys noticed that a lot of these, like, fast food restaurants, a lot of restaurants now are advertising 100% beef, and they're advertising all this stuff because they're getting caught with Soylent Green. That's what's going on, dude. I mean, I'm not kidding you. This stuff, they're literally feeding us Soylent Green. Soylent Green is people. You got to tell them, Jonesy. I mean, they're literally feeding us Soylent Green. It is. I mean, what else are we supposed to call them? I mean, this stuff ain't food, man. I don't know if you checked lately. I don't know if you've seen some of this stuff. I mean, it is bad news out there. Dollar rallies against the euro. What? Hold up a second. The dollar rallies against the euro, huh? Did I wake up in Never Never Land here? Did I wake up in the Twilight Zone? Well, I wake up in the freaking Twilight Zone every day. I don't know about you. Well, we're going to have a stimulus plan in here, and everything's going to be okay. We're going to bring change to the American people, and everything's going to be wonderful. And you can bet your bottom dollar, and I'm going to make it happen. I mean, Black Jesus just gets up there and just spouts some rhetoric, and boom, the dollar rallies. Because the people that control Obama control the money. Did you not figure that out yet? Smack, smack. Wake the hell up. In late morning trade, the European single currency dropped from $1,364.94 to $1,390.10 in New York for late on Friday. Man, high expectations for Obama appear to be supporting U.S. stocks and the dollar, although conditions surrounding the U.S. economy are still pretty negative. Oh, man. You have now entered the Twilight Zone. The dollar has rallied against the euro because Obama got up and spouted some rhetoric. Thank you very much. Man, oh man, U.S. opens new Iraq embassy and moves to normalize ties. The United States opened its new embassy building in Baghdad on Monday, a statement to symbolize the transition from occupying power to an ally of the sovereign American Iraqi government. Oh my God, dude. In recent weeks, U.S. diplomats have gradually moved into the $592 million newly built compound. The world's largest U.S. embassy building, leaving behind a sprawling palace they inhabited since toppling Iraqi's leader Saddam Hussein in 2003. They go and build the largest. Let me just get this straight. They go and build the largest U.S. embassy ever built, ever, anywhere on the face of the frickin' planet. They go and build the largest U.S. embassy ever, a $592 million compound in Iraq. If somehow that qualifies as Iraq sovereignty. I mean, they go and set up shop. They go and set up control in Iraq. They basically plant the flag and say, congratulations, Iraq. Congratulations to the Iraqi people that we, the few that we left that we didn't wipe out. Congratulations. You're now free. You now have a sovereign government. You know why? Because we just built the biggest embassy here. We're going to ensure the takeover. I mean, this is what qualifies as freedom now. You have, when you have another country come in, so if the EU comes over here and sets up an embassy over the United States and comes and depopulates half the American country, that's going to qualify as freedom. Yeah, bigger than the goddamn Vatican. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's freedom, man. That's where we're at. Woo-hoo! Oh, man. And you know the Iraqi people are just loving it. You know they're just loving it. I mean, this is what they got for the genocide. This is what they got for having their culture and their heritage raped and pillaged. This is what they got for, you know, having everything stolen from them and they're having genocide to them. They got a brand new embassy, baby. You're free. You love it. Final segment around the corner. Stay with us.
You are now the home of Cutting Edge Talk Radio.
I'm your host, Josh Reeves. I want to thank you so much for being with us. And there's a video going around from ABC News. I don't know if there's any audio to it. We'll play it. Apparently, there's a bunch of people are up in arms around Salt Lake City, Utah, and they were saying it was a giant UFO. Well, if you look at this thing, this is exactly the type of thing. I remember reading a story a few months ago talking about, I forget what website it was, but there was a website, one of those technology websites we covered here on this broadcast a few months ago. Well, they were talking about Homeland Security creating these blimps. Well, that's exactly what this is. It's a giant Homeland Security tracking, monitoring blimp. But apparently the people in Salt Lake City are up in arms. They thought it was a UFO. Let's see if there's any audio of this clip.
What's hovering over Salt Lake City? Is it a rocket, a blimp, a UFO? A strange object seen in the skies has residents scratching their heads. The craft floated overhead for several minutes before disappearing. Salt Lake air traffic controllers said their radar didn't pick up anything, and they have no knowledge of the craft.
Well, of course they don't have any knowledge of it. It's a Homeland Security tracking blimp. It's made for domestic surveillance. That's exactly what it is. I think Engadget was the website. I have to go back and find that. I can't remember the exact website. I had that story. I covered it here a few months ago. But it was the same exact thing. They were created these things for domestic surveillance. Here it is. Lockheed Martin to build high-altitude airship for Homeland Security. January 22nd, 2007. Although it's not exactly shocking to hear of yet another Homeland Security application that seems to border on Big Brother, Lockheed Martin's high-altitude airship could keep an elevated eye on 600 miles of U.S. countryside at any given time. And if all goes as planned, we'll have 11 of these floating over our everyday activities by the end of the decade. The HAA prototype is a ginormous airship that measures 17 times larger than Goodyear's rendition we're all used to seeing above sporting events. It's designed to hover 12 miles above the Earth in order to keep tabs on what's going on below. The airship is slated to be solar-powered and could stay in a geocentric orbit for up to a year, and if equipped with high-resolution cameras, a single one can cover everything between Toledo, Ohio, and New York City. While Lockheed Martin is thrilled with the top $40 million project they've been awarded, it's certainly understandable to get a little worried about how these blimps will actually be used. But a company spokesman suggested that the entire fleet could actually be used for border surveillance. And hey, we need a little help there anyway, right? There you go. Oh yeah, you got the link there in the chat room. There you go. That's strange. Yeah, I found that between the break and I was like, what the hell is going on here? Blimps from outer space, but I tell you what. Oh man, Cheney says Bush's actions legal if not impeached. He said that he literally said that if nobody, because he didn't get impeached, because Bush wasn't impeached, it's legal. It's, everything he did was legal. And we're back again with the Vice President. Mr. Vice President, in an interview last month with Chris Wallace over at Fox, you said that starting in 2001, the administration, and in many cases you personally, kept congressional leaders fully briefed on the program to monitor America's international phone calls without a warrant. You said that the Republican and Democratic leaders were unanimous when you briefed them that the programs were essential and did not require further congressional action. But the New York Times has noted that Senator Rockefeller wrote you a letter in 2003 reiterating concerns that he said he had expressed at those meetings that the programs raised profound issues and created concern regarding the direction the administration was taking. So were congressional leaders kept fully informed or were they not?
They were kept fully informed.
Well, why would he have written that letter?
I have no idea. I know when what happened was the everybody who was in the room that day, for example, when I got the leadership down, chairman and ranking member of the intelligence committees, including Senator Rockefeller, and asked them if we thought they should continue, if they thought we should continue the program. They said, yes. Do we need to come to Congress to get authorization for it? They said, no. And he was there. He never objected or opposed that in any way. Later on, when this became public, when the New York Times broke the story, which, frankly, I think was an outrageous decision on their part, they were asked by the President of the United States not to, on the grounds it would damage national security. Then Senator Rockefeller decided he wanted to hark back to this letter. But the fact was he couldn't even find it. He had to call my office for a copy of the letter that he allegedly had written some years before, raising some questions that he had about the program. But I always felt it was a bit of a CYA letter. And in those crucial meetings, when we sat down to debate the program and tell them about it, in fact, everybody in the room signed up to it. Nobody.
That was a CYA letter. Yeah, you know how to CYA, don't you? You know how to cover your ass. That's all you guys know how to do. That's it. I don't have time to play all that douchebag clip today. But you know what? All he does is go on to say that if Bush isn't impeached, that everything that he did is legal. Well, we know it's not freaking legal, but it doesn't matter them saying that it is. I mean, it's what we talked about earlier. Look, I mean, the laws and all this stuff, it's not legal, they can't do it, blah, blah, blah. You know, I had somebody, had a conversation with somebody last week, and we were talking about the surveillance drones and Global Hawks and all this stuff, and I literally had somebody say to me, well, they can't do that. They said that on the news that it's illegal for them to fly Global Hawks and fly over and look for grow lights in your closet. You think that stops these people from doing it? You think some law about domestic surveillance stops these people for a damn second? No! Police have to step up hacking of home PCs. Well, isn't that great? The Home Office has quietly adopted a new plan to allow police across Britain routinely to hack into people's personal computers without a warrant. Now, what did we talk about earlier with Lockheed Martin? What did I tell you that Lockheed Martin was doing now? Setting the precedent for being able to do this openly? They're already doing it in the UK, folks. They're always a couple of years ahead of us as far as Big Brother tyranny goes, and this is yet another example of that. State of the Sun for the year 2008, all is quiet on the solar front. Too quiet. The NOAA Space Weather Prediction Center updated their plots of solar indices earlier today. On January 3rd, with the exception of a slight increase in the 107-centimeter radio flux, there appears to be even less signs of solar activity. Sunspots are still not following either of the two predictive curves, and it appears that the solar dynamo continues to slumber, perhaps even winding down further. Now, folks, I don't know if you've noticed the chemtrail activity in your area over the past few weeks. I don't know if you've noticed this. They have been creating and trapping the heat down at the ground level. This is what they're doing. If they didn't work trapping the heat right now, the entire North America that we're in right now would be in a complete deep freeze. They're trapping the heat down at the surface level by creating a greenhouse shield with chemtrails, folks. This is why they're spraying sulfur hexafluoride. I told you that a year ago. This is why they're spraying the most toxic greenhouse gas known to man in the atmosphere. They're having to create global warming, folks, because we're going into a cooling. That's our show. Don't forget about our fundraiser, theglobalreality.com and myspace.com/globalrealityshow. My name is Josh Reeves. I love each and every one of you. See you guys back here tomorrow for the show. Take care.
My name is Chris Milligan, publisher of Trine Day Books, 2012.
We have a new president coming into office in January. His number one word of use is change. What if the change was not the change America expected? What if all natural products were handed over to the pharmaceutical companies to be eradicated? What if the only remedy for sickness and disease was to take drugs?
Cutting Edge Talk Radio.